I am Seth Dillon. I'm the CEO of the Babylon Bee, the world's most trusted, factually accurate news source. Some of you have heard of it. Our tagline is fake news you can trust. And you may be shocked to hear this. I was shocked when I found this out myself, but we have, at this point, surpassed The Onion, which some of you may have heard of, in traffic and engagement. So we're now the world's most popular satire site. And this is the really crazy thing. Let this sink in for a second. The world's most popular satire site is a Christian satire site. How did they let that happen? They've actually tried to stop that from happening, and it's happened despite their best efforts. Some of those efforts I'm going to talk about a little bit. You're going to hear something interesting. While we were sitting back there before I came out, there was reference to me coming out and teaching, and I don't think teaching is the right word for what I'm going to be doing. I don't know. You guys can be the judge of that. But you will hear a moral case for mockery. And I don't know that you've ever heard that before, so this might be new for some of you. I don't think it will surprise any of you to hear from me right now that we're living in kind of crazy times, unusually crazy times, actually outrageous times, where absurdity is everywhere. And I like to quote G.K. Chesterton. He's one of my favorite writers and thinkers. And I don't think this was a particularly profound thought, but he had said at one point, in fact, back in 1911, that the world has become too absurd to be satirized. In 1911. Things were a little different in 1911. Can you even imagine what G.K. Chesterton would say if he were alive right now and seeing the kinds of things that we're seeing going on in this world? Truth is under attack. Reason is under attack. Comedy is under attack. And you can't speak up and try to defend any of these things, or they try to suppress your voice and silence you. Freedom of speech is under attack. And I think that is a warning for all of us, especially Christians, who want to be able to voice ourselves speaking the truth boldly in the public square, where that's increasingly becoming more and more difficult. Some of the examples I think that Chesterton might be shocked by if he were to hear this stuff. I mean, this is a weird one, but a study at Stanford found that students were more likely to wear masks on bikes than helmets. They're riding around on sidewalks and streets where they could fall and hit their heads. Outdoors, by the way, they're distance. You're on a bike. I mean, you're not too crowded when you're on a bike. They're wearing masks instead of helmets. This is where the smart kids go, right, Stanford? COVID really drew out the insanity, somehow it's not behind us yet at this point. But do you remember there was a time in this country not that long ago when you could go to bars, you could go to casinos, you could go to strip clubs, but you couldn't gather to worship at church because that would be like a super spreader event or something? That actually happened. Do you guys remember that? That wasn't that long ago. That was crazy. There was actually one church that got really creative and got around that. There was a church in Nevada that was not allowed to hold services. So you know what they did? They went to a casino and they prayed and worshiped in a casino as a group. Unbelievable that actually had to happen. It wasn't long ago we were told men weren't allowed to have an opinion on abortion. You know what we're told now? Men can get pregnant. And it's like, it's funny, but is it? You go to healthline.com. Healthline.com. Type in the search query. Can men get pregnant? You know what healthline.com will tell you? Yes, and in fact, it's probably more common than you realize. Healthline. This is science today. This is truth. Unbelievable. I think one of the most, I think, extreme examples, or ridiculous examples, in my memory, is when we had a Supreme Court nominee posed with the question, would you be able to define what a woman is for us? And she's sitting there, as a woman, by the way, and says, "I'm sorry, I'm not a biologist. I can't answer that question." She declined to answer the question, "What is a woman?" Can you, like, do you think Chesterton would have thought that was normal or sane? The world was too absurd to be satirized back then. She couldn't answer that question. Now, I see what look like a lot of women here tonight. I think. Or at least some of you were assigned female at birth. The doctor made his best guess, and you just went with it. This is nuts. Men are dominating women's sports. Does anybody have a problem with that? Men are being named Woman of the Year. I'm going to come back to that one, actually, because we got in a little bit of trouble for doing a joke about a man who was named Woman of the Year. This one actually makes me angry. It's not funny. Drag shows for kids are everywhere, and if you call it grooming, you'll get banned permanently on all of the major social platforms. Kind of makes me angry. I have 2 young kids, you know? I don't even want to laugh at that one. But this is actually one of the ways that, well, this is, the truth is under attack in all of these examples, right? But comedy's under attack too, because we're trying our best to exaggerate the truth, to do satirical jokes, and the world is so absurd, it's basically a parody of itself. So it makes our job kind of challenging. And what ends up happening is our writers have to work harder and then they demand more money. You just got a paycheck a month ago. Why do you need another one? They want more money. They're working harder. It's a lot harder to do their job. And their jokes keep coming true. Have any of you seen? Have any of you seen Babylon Bee Fulfilled Prophecies before? I want to show you some examples because it's way better to show than tell. I always love when I have a screen I can throw these up on. Pant sales plummet as everyone working from home. All right. What I'm starting with, this is a Babylon Bee headline, so I'll show you the Babylon Bee headline first, and I'll show you the real headline following it. This is a silly joke, you know. This is a COVID joke. Everybody's working from... You guys have probably done this. You worked remotely. Who needs pants when you're working remotely? Sitting there in his pink boxers. Well, this was March 25th of 2020. Fast forward 1 day later... Amid coronavirus, Walmart says it's seeing increased sales of tops, but not bottoms. It was really happening. We were kidding, but apparently, this was actually playing itself out in retail stores. 1 day later, Progressive Church announces new drag queen Bible story hour. Babylon Bee headline. We were thinking with this one, you know, when I say satire, the project of satire is to exaggerate the truth to make a point. Well, we were starting to see all of these drag queen story hours happening in libraries, and we're like, well, what would be even worse than that? Well, what if they did it in a church? Okay, so it started as a joke, and apparently someone read our website, got the idea, and threw a drag Bible study class for children, no less, at a woke Chicago church. The pastor decided to host a children's Bible study class while in drag. Can you believe that? Why, by the way? How does that do anything but distract from a Bible study? The reading, the story hour too, I don't understand. If you want kids to be paying attention to the story, why are you putting a distracting person in front of them? You know, what's the purpose? How does it add to the story hour? I don't know. I don't get it. Gavin Newsom named U-Haul Salesperson of the Year. I was just recently in Texas, and they really appreciated this one because so many people are flocking to Texas from California. They're interested in building a wall around the entire state to keep people out. But this was September 15th of 2021, and if you fast forward a little bit to January 7th of 2022, Californians fleeing for Texas so fast, U-Haul runs out of trucks for them. He really was the salesperson of the year for U-Haul. I love this one. To improve public perception, Kamala Harris taking likability lessons from Hillary Clinton. It's funny because that's the last person you would take likability lessons from, right? There's no way that would ever happen. White House asked Hillary staffers how to make Kamala more likable. It's even, look at the pictures too, like how similar the pictures, this is how we did it, this is how they did it. Cackling Kamala there. I think there was a month difference. Yeah, this was July, and then this happened in August. So 1 month to the fulfillment of this prophecy. You know, Shakespeare actually wrote in King Lear, jesters do oft prove prophets. We're finding that is the case in really weird ways. This is one of my all-time favorites. Trump, I have done more for Christianity than Jesus. Now, I've shown this slide with members of his family in the room. And they thought it was funny. This is a joke, you know. It's outlandish personality with Trump. He says some crazy things sometimes. He does have an ego, this guy. And I could see him saying that. Apparently, other people could, too, because this went crazy viral. There were reporters who worked for the New York Times who shared this, believing it was true. So next thing you know, Snopes fact checks it and rates it false. Fact check a joke, okay, we've got to make everybody know this is not harmful misinformation, this is just a joke. But fast forward just a little bit, Trump is currently calling into Flashpoint, a prophecy-focused conservative talk show on Kenneth Copeland's Victory Channel. Nobody has done more for Christianity or for evangelicals or for religion itself than I have. He took it a step further. He went to religion itself, all the world's religions, not just Christianity. So now my question is, what is Snopes supposed to do? Because they've already rated this false. They need a new category for jokes that might come true down the road or have now come true down the road. Prophecy fulfilled needs to be a new category on the Snopes website. But this is the interesting thing. It's one of the chief criticisms that we get from people. I don't understand this criticism. I don't know how, you know, if you guys spend a lot of time watching comedy shows or going to stand-up comedy or whatever. But the criticism is that our jokes are too believable. You know, we're doing something wrong. We must be deliberately trying to mislead all of you by making these jokes so believable. And it's just the weirdest criticism of comedy to me. Jokes are funny because of their proximity to the truth, not their distance from it, right? I mean, everybody here has heard the saying, it's funny because it's true. It's funny because it's true. If you divorce a joke from reality so far that no one could possibly believe it, then it's not going to be funny and it's not going to make a point. So I think it's kind of a weird and silly criticism of us. You know, it's funny because it's true, and that's also why attacks on comedy are attacks on the truth. Because there is a grain of truth to the jokes that we're making, not just us, but comedians in general. The reason we laugh, we throw our heads back and we laugh at comedians is because they're saying something that resonates. They're saying something true. Attacks on comedy are attacks on truth itself in many ways. Now, I don't like getting fact-checked. I don't like having my jokes rated false. I don't think they have a truth rating, but they have truth to them. Now, there's another thing that's being done, which I think is really, this is actually much more harmful. But there's a way that they're coming after comedy and speech in general, but comedy I'll focus on because it affects us so directly. But they're making all these rules about what you can and can't joke about. They're creating rules about what you can and can't joke about. And a lot of comedians are playing along, by the way. There's a lot of comedians who are like refusing to make jokes that could potentially get them canceled or suspended. Others, fortunately, are being bold. But they have you basically tiptoeing through a minefield, trying not to step on one of these mines. And man, if you do, you're actually putting your life at risk. Do you remember what happened to Chris Rock? He got slapped by Will Smith. He made a joke that wasn't received well. That didn't used to happen. Dave Chappelle's been attacked, too, on stage. He's making jokes he's not supposed to make. People are offended. His words were violent. So what do they do? they hit him? The New York Post just recently did a story about how there is a rising wave of criminal assault against comedians in nightclubs. They now need security when they go on stage. I think we have security here right now to watch my back. Never know which one of you crazy people is going to run up here and try to slap me. It's insane. But the thing that's weirdest to me, the rule that's weirdest to me that I reject, by the way, wholeheartedly, is the idea of punching down. Comedians are not supposed to punch down. You're not allowed to punch down. I don't know if you guys are familiar with punching down and what that means. But basically, what they're saying when they say that a comedian can't punch down is they're saying, you're not supposed to joke about people who are beneath you. You're not supposed to joke about people who have less power than you, less privilege than you. If you do that, you're punching down. And it's a really weird situation to be in as a comedian, as a satirist or a humorist, a comedy writer of any kind, to be thinking to yourself, not, is this funny when you're writing a joke, but am I making fun of somebody who sees themselves as being more marginalized or oppressed than me and is going to be offended by it? Are they going to think I'm punching down at them? And just think about it for a moment. Like, imagine how condescending it is to think to yourself, you know what? I shouldn't joke about those people. They're beneath me. That kind of puts it in perspective, right? Could you imagine sitting there and thinking to yourself, I shouldn't joke about those people. They're beneath me. I have more than, I'm better than them. You know, they're down here. I'm up here. If we are all created equally in God's image, then shouldn't we be able to joke about each other indiscriminately? Right? Isn't that the way of treating each other equally? If I were to make a joke about women, I'd be punching down because men supposedly have more power and privilege than women in our society. Well, I would only be reinforcing that if I acted like I couldn't make jokes about women because they're beneath me. I'm reinforcing that idea. If I joke about them, I'm treating them equally. So I will. I'll continue to joke about you throughout the night. And you will like it and not slap me. You guys may not know this. We have not tweeted since March. And the reason we haven't tweeted since March is because we punched down. I don't agree that we punched down, but we did. Allegedly punched down. I want to show you the real story that we did a joke about first. I'll show you the real story, then I'll show you our joke. This is why we're locked in Twitter jail since March right now. USA Today names transgender Biden official as one of its women of the year. Beautiful woman here. Stunning. So we did this joke. Babylon Bee's man of the year is Rachel Levine. Now, if you go to a dictionary, for now, the dictionary is changing rapidly. I suggest you buy a hard, like bound, like printed copy of the dictionary and save it, preferably one from several years ago. A man is an adult human male. That's what a man is. So, Rachel Levine, man of the year. This is a male person. I don't see any problem with that. Well, Twitter sees a problem with that. This is misgendering. This is hateful conduct. This is a marginalized and oppressed person, and we're punching down on them. So what does Twitter do? They say, look, you violated our hateful conduct policy. You need to delete this tweet, or your account will remain locked. And when you look at the delete button, right over the delete button is this bright red font, and it says, by deleting this tweet, you acknowledge that you engaged in hateful conduct. I did not click the button. Back to what I was saying a moment ago, there's a grain of truth in these jokes, right? Now, we did not actually name Rachel Levine Man of the Year because we don't assign awards like Man of the Year. This is satire, right? But there's truth here. This is a man that we're talking about. This is a male person. A man is an adult male human. There's truth to this joke. We're pushing back on a lie that they're trying to require everybody to affirm. So there's truth here. And they want us to acknowledge that we engage in hateful conduct. You know what? I don't think the truth is hate speech. The truth is not hate speech. So we had a decision to make. We're like, you know, we have to make a decision about whether or not we're going to delete this joke and acknowledge that we engage in hate speech. And within about 5 minutes, we deliberated on it and we decided, no, we're not going to, come what may. And that's interesting. You know, it is rather costly for us because we have 1.5 million followers on Twitter. That's a large audience. And it's Twitter's where meaningful conversations happen. You know, Twitter's where a lot of public, there's a lot of nonsense that happens on Twitter, I know. But this is where public officials are talking to the public. This is where a lot of celebrities communicate with their followings. There's tremendous amounts of public discourse that takes place on these platforms. And to be sidelined from that and the connections that we get through that, we were being retweeted by the president, we're retweeted by Congress people, we're retweeted by Elon Musk. You know, we're reaching these people, and now we can't. And there's a cost to that, beyond just the traffic that it drives to the website. I can't even put a dollar amount on the cost to that. But we don't want to delete the joke, because if somebody doesn't stand up and say, hey, look, we're not going on, you're trying to get me to say that 2 and 2 make 5, 2 and 2 make 4, and I refuse to go along with that. Why are we one of the only ones doing that? Why aren't there millions of people doing that? I think that's an important question that we all need to be willing to ask ourselves. So Elon Musk finds out about this. You guys may have heard of him. He's a entrepreneur and CEO, pretty influential guy, very interesting guy. We interviewed him in December on our podcast. And so, you know, he's been following us and interacting with our stuff for some time, but he found out that we were suspended on Twitter, and he wanted to confirm that that was actually the case. And he had a conversation with us about it, and he's like, man, you know what? I might have to buy Twitter. Then he goes and makes a bid to buy Twitter. I did not expect that. And I don't take full credit for that, by the way. I think that, you know, Elon is concerned about free speech. He's concerned about the suppression of free speech and what that means. And he's not concerned about it from a Christian perspective. He's not concerned about the religious liberty, the rights that come with being able to exercise your religious freedom. He's primarily concerned about it from a standpoint of he thinks that it's dangerous and harmful to have like people in power being the arbiters of what can and can't be said in the public square. He doesn't think that should be the case. He thinks free speech should be restored there. And he really pushes back hard on wokeness and the dangers of wokeness. I don't know if many of you have seen the interview that we did with him back in December, but he said, when I asked him why he thought wokeness was so bad, he said, wokeness is divisive, it's exclusionary, it's hateful. It gives mean people an excuse to be cruel while armored in false virtue. I mean, how good is that? And then he turned to us and he looked at us and he goes, I don't know, what do you guys think? I couldn't have said it better than that. I think he's got a point. But he understands the importance of speech, and you know he reached out to us specifically because of this joke, you know, this that got us in trouble. You know, that's it's taking a stand for these things, taking a stand for the truth, not just comedy, but for the truth that's underlying the comedy, that the comedy is riding on the back of. Taking a stand for that gets the attention sometimes of some people in positions of power and influence who might come to your aid. I don't know if this deal is going to go through or not. I don't know what is ultimately going to be the result here, but we have emboldened, I think, some other people, and we have brought a lot of attention to this issue, and hopefully there's an outcome that we can be happy with. But the point here is that they do not actually have a problem with hate speech. They don't. They just hate speech. All of this is crafty ways of engaging in speech suppression. They're creating rules to protect their sacred cows and shut down criticism of what they believe, you know, what their agenda is. And I think the really crucial point to make when we're talking about this whole situation with, you know, punching down and joking about the marginalized and the oppressed, you know, I think maybe some Christians will hear that and think that that, you know, well, is it the Christian thing to do to make fun of people who are marginalized and oppressed? I don't think Rachel Levine is marginalized and oppressed. This is a white male, high-ranking government official that has everyone backing them up, from the media, education institutions, the most powerful people in politics, the biggest corporations. We are not punching down when we make jokes that poke holes in the popular progressive narrative. I think we're punching back. And honestly, it's punching up. It's punching up by definition. These things come from the top down. They're being pushed on us from the top down. These are not popular ideas, by the way. You poll most people, and these are not popular ideas. The idea that there's such a thing as a transgender 3-year-old, is that a popular idea? But I can't make fun of that idea, that bad idea. I can't mock that bad idea without it being punching down. Why? That idea is coming from the top down. It's not from the bottom up. It's not popular with the common people. So I think we're punching back, we're punching up, if anything. And you can really tell who holds the power. You know, it's very true. I don't know who said it originally. This quote gets attributed to a bunch of different people. But you can tell who holds the power in a society based on who you're allowed to criticize and who you're not allowed to criticize, who you're allowed to joke about, who you're not allowed to joke about. People in positions of power tend to be very touchy, and they want to shut up the people who are joking about them. If you have both the will and the power to punish and silence and cancel anyone who so much as makes fun of you, are you marginalized and oppressed? I don't think so. I think you're the oppressor. That's scary power. They have scary power. It reminds me some of the scene in, maybe it's been a while since some of you have seen this, but The Dark Knight Rises, that Batman movie, remember with Bane? There's a scene in that movie where someone, some wealthy political figure who Bane is supposedly working for. So this guy's supposed to be in charge, right? This guy dismisses somebody from the room, and Bane tells the guy, no, you stay. And this rich political guy, I don't remember the character's name, turns to Bane and he says, what are you doing? He's not going to listen to you. I'm in charge. And Bane, who's huge, like me. Why are you laughing? I work out. Bane, who's big and strong and attractive like me, puts his hand on this guy's neck, like right next to his head. And he goes, do you feel in charge? Do you remember that scene? It's a great scene. Then he snaps his neck and kills him. That was a great Bane impression, by the way. Please clap. I do not feel in charge when the slightest slip up, stepping on a little minefield, in this minefield, stepping on one of these mines, upsets somebody who has the power to shut me up permanently in the public square. I do not feel in charge. That's the point of that little illustration. And so I just think it's exactly the opposite of what they're telling you that it is. It's complete projection. It's total projection. They're doing what they're accusing us of doing. They're doing what they're saying is the problem. They are, in fact, wielding tremendous amounts of power and silencing and censoring anybody who challenges that power. And it's the comedian's job to challenge that power. I think the comedian's job is to tell the truth, like I've said. The comedian's job is to poke holes in the popular narrative. Have you guys noticed how comedy isn't funny anymore? You watch late-night comedy? I don't anymore. But if you watch the late-night comics, have you noticed they're going for, like, the applause of affirmation from their audience? They're preaching. They're not going for the laughter of amusement anymore. It's a weird thing. They're propping up the popular narratives and getting everybody to clap for them when they should be, like the court jester, making fun of the king, holding him accountable, mocking the ideas that deserve to be mocked. They're not doing that. And I think they're doing everybody a disservice. Because if you think about it, and I want to try to say this the right way, I tweeted it earlier, and I got to remember exactly how I put it. The absurd has become sacred only because it hasn't been mocked sufficiently. The absurd has become sacred only because it hasn't been mocked sufficiently. I think that's true. I think comedians bear a lot of the guilt for young people thinking that these crazy ideas that are coming from the top down are acceptable. Why do we think they're acceptable? Why do we take them seriously? Why haven't we mocked them to the sidelines? That should have happened. I think we had a moral obligation to make that happen. And we've been trying to do that, but we're being silenced in the process, which is pretty scary. I want to show you a few more examples. Sorry, that got very serious for a little bit. But you did get a great Bane impression out of it. I want to show you some examples of one of the other ways that they're attacking comedy with fact-checking. And I have some really interesting and funny examples of this. So I'll show you a few more of these. But this is the first one. This is what started it all off. CNN purchases industrial-sized washing machine to spin the news before publication. That is so dumb. That is stupid. It's not even that funny. It's just dumb. A big CNN logo on a washing machine. That is so obviously not true, okay? Snopes fact-checked this joke and rated it false. Facebook then sent us a message and said that if you continue to publish fake news, false news on our platform, we're going to kick you off and demonetize your page. And we're like, wait a minute, this joke? I actually reached out to Snopes. I had an email dialogue with the president of Snopes about this joke back in 2018. And I said, what is your criteria for deciding which jokes you're going to fact check? Because I think this is absolutely insane that you guys fact check this. We realize we got dinged on Facebook for this, and they want to kick us off because we're spreading fake news. Like, why are you guys fact checking our jokes? And he said, well, we only fact check jokes that cross a certain threshold where enough people have asked us, is this true? My reply was simple. I said, show me one person who emailed you asking. That's not a troll, by the way, not somebody that you planted. Show me one legitimate email from somebody who wrote to you and said, is this joke true? He stopped replying to me. I never heard from him again. Isn't that crazy? CNN praises Taliban for wearing masks during attack. I like the Chiron here at the bottom. Taliban fighters responsibly wearing masks. It's covering their nose and mouth. Now, this goes back to what we said a moment ago about how our jokes are too believable, right? We make them too believable. Why is this believable? Is it the fault of the satirist that this is believable, or is it the fault of CNN and their track record that people might believe this is true? I think it's an indictment of CNN. Not the satirist who wrote it. I didn't write this one. I wish I did. But this got fact-checked and rated false. Ocasio-Cortez appears on The Price is Right, guesses everything is free. That one's believable. I get it. You know, it's actually a pretty good Photoshop, too. If you kind of study this one, like, the reflection on her name tag, like, you really think she's there, right? Once again, the dopes at Snopes got this one, rated it false. She did not actually go on The Price is Right and guess that everything is free. But she might have. Ninth Circuit Court overturns death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. All right, I have questions. How do you overturn somebody's death? Now, I know God raised Jesus from the dead, but I don't think the Ninth Circuit Court has that power. National Review did a piece on this fact check, because USA Today is the one that fact checked this one. USA Today fact checked this joke And you know, if I was fact-checking a joke like this, do you know how lengthy it would be? How detailed it would be? I would say, if it was my job, if I had the terrible job of fact-checking jokes, I would write a single sentence. I would say, this joke originated from the Babylon Bee. It's satire. That's what I would say. They cited 15 sources. They called the Ninth Circuit Court. They checked the Ninth Circuit Court's website. 15 sources. And their lengthy refutation of this joke. National Review did a piece on this and said it was the stupidest fact check in history. The really crazy thing about this one is if you scroll to the bottom of the page underneath the fact check, if you can get to the end of the works cited, it says in italicized font, this fact check was paid for by grants from Facebook. So Facebook is paying USA Today to give our jokes a truth rating so that then they can come back to us and say, you keep spreading false information on our websites and we're going to limit your reach on our platform and deplatform if you keep doing it. Isn't that crazy and circular and stupid and dumb and harmful? And what other words can we come up with for that? It's ridiculous. Evil's a good one. I think it's evil. I mean, there's no reason to be fact-checking these jokes in the first place. Nobody thought that the Ninth Circuit Court had overturned Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Nobody even understands what that means. But it was an excuse to rate one of our jokes false, which gives them an excuse to limit our reach, which gives them the power of having fewer people exposed to mockery of their ideas. Interesting, isn't it? If that's the word you want to use. But the media has come after us too. Brian Stelter called us a hoax satire site. What does that mean? So we're not really satire? Does that mean it's real news? The New York Times said that we were misinformation under the let me get it right. They said we were a far-right misinformation site that sometimes traffics in misinformation under the guise of satire. That's an exact quote. That's what the New York Times said about us. So we threatened to sue them. We did. It's, you know, we like to the extent that we can, we like to try to, I always leave a slide up there, but thankfully they took care of that for me. To the extent that we can, we like to stay in character and joke about these things. You know, we like the levity, so we want to be sarcastic and funny and witty with this stuff and joke about it. But in certain cases, you know, calling us a far-right misinformation site that's trafficking in misinformation while pretending to be satirists, do you know what that's going to result in? If that's in the New York Times, then it's going to be on our Wikipedia page. Once it's on our Wikipedia page, it's what everybody's going to look at. Next thing you know, we're going to be on hate watch lists. We're not going to be able to do payment processing. We're not going to be able to have web hosting. We're going to be a dangerous, far-right misinformation site. Nobody's going to want to do business with us. We have to take that seriously. It sucks, but we have to take that seriously. So, you know, we threatened to sue them, and they retracted it. Who would have thought? 5 days later, New York Times. So why do they attack comedy? I'll tell you why. Well, actually, I'll let Chesterton tell you why. Humor can get in under the door while seriousness is still fumbling at the handle. How good is that? Humor is effective. It's a vehicle for truth delivery. It's disarming. You can talk about the most controversial subject in the world, but if you wrap your message in the package of humor, it's more easily delivered and received than anything else. It's way better as a communication tool for getting the truth across to somebody than arguing with them until you're blue in the face or until they block you. It's very effective. It's one of the reasons why they're coming after it, I think, why they're trying to attack it. And they're using all these creative ways to do it. You know, when they talk about content moderation, you hear that term a lot, content moderation, you know, that's a euphemism for censorship. When they talk about misinformation, they're trying to crack down on misinformation. Misinformation is opinions they don't like. That's what it is. Hate speech, well, there really is hate speech that people engage in, sure. They say hateful things all the time about people, specifically targeting them for their identity or, you know, their race, their creed, whatever. But the word has become so diluted now because they throw it at everybody. Everybody's a bigot. Everybody that they disagree with is engaging in hate speech. It's literally just a word that they use to smear anyone they disagree with. So we can't let them get away with just calling it content moderation. This goes way beyond content moderation. Twitter is not taking down lewd and indecent content. That's there. You will find it. What they're taking down is stuff that's either funny or true or both. They will not take down what's lewd and deep. They will not take down video of a drag queen performing for children. But they will take down our jokes. Is that objective content moderation? I don't think so. But one thing that we shouldn't do, that we should never do when we're accused of hate speech or misinformation, you know, when we're simply trying to make a point with a joke, is apologize. Please never apologize to the cancel mob. Do you know what that does? You know what happens when you apologize to the cancel mob? You feed it, and it gets bigger and stronger. Starve it. Starve the cancel mob. Do not apologize to it. You can apologize. Thank you. You can apologize if you've offended somebody that you know and love, that you have an interpersonal relationship with, and they come to you and they say, hey, look, what you said hurt me. You know, there's some humility to be had there to say, well, even if I stand by what I said, I'm sorry that I made you feel that way. Apologies make sense in that context. But in the context of people that you've never met, that you didn't actually hurt, that are far away, that don't actually engage with your business, your products, your services, who are just enraged because they want to use fake outrage as a tool to bludgeon you into silence, do not apologize to them, please, I beg you. When you censor yourself, you do the tyrant's work for him. So never censor yourself. It makes it much easier for them. Make them ban you. Make them silence you. Don't do the tyrant's work for him. I would like to see, you know, when people ask how they can be supportive, I would like to see a lot of people stand up. I would like to see millions of people get banned. Make them ban themselves into irrelevance because they're banning so many people. They'll have to stop. It's only when we're standing up one at a time as little outliers that we're easy to silence. So, you know, how do we respond in the face of these attacks? Are we discouraged? That's really probably the most common question that I get. No, I'm not discouraged. Are you kidding me? Do you know what would discourage me more than anything else is if the New York Times liked us. When you're taking flack, you're over the target. It means you're doing something right. Don't be discouraged when they're attacking you. Speak the truth boldly, and when the attacks come, wear it like a badge of honor because it means you're being effective. So the other thing I would say, too, is there's this, I think, a pressure on us to be, you know, really loving and tolerant and affirming, especially as Christians. And speaking the truth, I think, is more loving than affirming a lie. Sometimes the truth hurts. Sometimes the truth's divisive. Sometimes it's very offensive. But it's always more loving than lying to somebody or affirming lies that actually do real-world harm to other people when they become popularly believed and pervasive and permeate our society. So, why do we need humor and satire? Why are they important? How am I on time, by the way? Is anybody tracking that? I don't know if we have that. Keep going. Why do we need humor and satire? What is the moral case for mockery? I'm going to throw a C.S. Lewis quote at you. Has any of you ever heard of C.S. Lewis? He's my favorite author. And I've quoted Chesterton twice, so I have to get a Lewis quote in there. He said, good philosophy must exist if for no other reason because bad philosophy needs to be answered. Good philosophy must exist, if for no other reason, because bad philosophy needs to be answered. Satire is necessary for exactly the same reason. Satire ridicules bad ideas. And I think there's a moral good to ridiculing bad ideas before they can take root in people's minds and hearts, especially in the minds and hearts of young people who are susceptible to them, who don't have the philosophical or theological foundations under them to insulate them and protect them against those bad ideas. We also need humor and satire because it holds us accountable. I think it's healthy to take our own things and throw them up on the wall with a projector and see if we're okay with them. Introspection, you know, examine ourselves. That's a healthy thing. Taking ourselves less seriously. Do you know how much healthier it would be if we weren't all upset that the wrong pronouns were used? Is that a healthy place to be in? And by the way, how oppressed are you if that's your worry in life? Come on. There's real oppression out there that these people have not known. But we do need levity. We need to take ourselves less seriously. I think that's vitally important. We all take ourselves way too seriously. The church included, by the way. The church needs laughter. And I think it's good to be leading with levity. And getting, why would we take ourselves so seriously? Why are we so important? And who thinks we're right all the time? You know, we're all passengers on the proverbial ship of fools from time to time, aren't we? We're all hypocritical at times. We all deserve a little bit of fun to be poked at us from time to time. Maybe not me, but but that guy. I love the description. There's a book called God Mocks, and it goes through some of the history of satire in religion, in the church, and in the Bible. And the author in the introduction or the first chapter, I don't remember which, don't hold me to it, but he said something to the effect of, you know, satire cuts. It does cut. It stings. But it wounds for the purpose of healing, the way that a scalpel does, okay? Satire cuts like a scalpel, not a knife. You're not stabbing somebody. You're cutting them for the purpose of healing. You're trying to cut out something bad. You're trying to expose something bad and deal with it, draw it to somebody's attention. I think that's a good thing. I think that's a morally good thing. Satire ridicules bad ideas. If I could sum up our mission statement, that would be our mission statement. It's to ridicule bad ideas. And I think also, by the way, what we're dealing with, when I mentioned the attack on truth, the attack on reason, so much of what we're seeing today can be described as an example of people who have given up on rationality on purpose. They're not just, you know, they're not crazy. They are deliberately choosing to say that 2 and 2 make 5 instead of 2 and 2 make 4. It's a choice. They're doing it on purpose. And when someone's abandoned rationality on purpose, I think the only response, you certainly can't reason with them. What reason are you going to appeal to in a person that has given up on rationality on purpose? But you can ridicule their bad ideas. You can subject them to mockery, and then other people will see just how crazy and ridiculous it is, and fewer people will take it seriously. And it won't end up affecting our kids. I think that makes sense. We've found ourselves somehow, I don't know how, we are a comedy site. We make jokes on the internet. We have found ourselves caught up in a battle for the preservation of freedom and the restoration of sanity. I don't know how that happened. I don't know how it happened, honestly. But here we are, and we're taking a stand for the truth. And I think the truth is of vital importance, and I think it's communicated through humor better than anything else. And I love this quote by Harold Clurman. Write this one down. Make them laugh, and while their mouths are open, pour truth in. Thank you.
I think they like you. We are going to take the next half an hour to answer some of your questions on cancel culture. And so Seth and I are just going to take a quick seat, and I've already have some questions for you, Seth. And if we could just get this pulpit out of the way, that would be great. You can text your questions in now to 703-844-9969. And the number there is on the back wall. 703-844-9969. And we're just going to spend the next half hour again asking Seth some questions on cancel culture. And feel free to send in personal questions as well, applying to your direct situation. But I'll just start us off. We kind of want to get to know you, a little bit more about you, Seth. What's been your faith journey? How did you come to know the Lord? And how did you come upon the Babylon Bee?
Well, I had the great fortune of being a pastor's kid. So
they're dangerous.
I didn't mention that earlier. I didn't mention my pronouns or that. I grew up in the church, so yeah. You know, I had very sound biblical doctrine. I actually have some of my old church family with me here today, which is cool to see. So they can vouch for the truth of it. My dad really is a pastor, right? Pretty good one. you know, I've been a Christian since I was a child. I was baptized as a child, and obviously, you know, I probably went through that, especially in my teen years, the converting all over again and praying the sinner's prayer over. Am I really saved? I did that a few times. I couldn't pinpoint the time I finally got it right. but I've been saved since I was a young man, and I went to a Christian university, Palm Beach Atlantic University, from 2000 to 2004. I struck out on my own as an entrepreneur in around 2012, working with my brother as my business partner, and we were building and selling businesses, and the bee just came across my radar as something that was really fun and funny and potentially extremely impactful. And I approached it initially as an investment opportunity. I approached the guy who had started. His name is Adam Ford. He's a brilliant guy. He had a Christian comic thing that he was doing online for a while that developed an audience. And then he launched The Bee in 2016. It went viral almost immediately. It got on my radar pretty quickly because it was shared a lot in church circles. And I offered to invest in it in 2018. And he said, no, I want to sell it. And I ended up working out a deal with him to take it over. So... That's the short version of that story.
I love, you know, how basically your message is, listen, even within the church, we can take ourselves too seriously. Let's make fun of ourselves. I've actually got two of my favorite ones, if we could throw those up on the screens here. The first one, the Holy Spirit is unable to move through congregation as fog machine breaks. See, this is just fun stuff.
So the story behind this one, actually, I didn't know that you were going to throw these up there, but this was submitted to us by a construction worker named Kyle Mann the week the website launched.
Okay.
And
Kyle's
Adam,
on your team now.
Kyle's now our editor-in-chief.
Yeah.
So he's good.
I like, if we could throw up the second one, this is one of my favorites, Seth, because I want you to actually rate our pulpit. So...
it's gone. There is no pulpit.
So I don't know. I think ours is made of like a metal or something. Would that be like okay theology?
You know, we haven't assigned a rating to that one yet. I don't know. It'd probably fall somewhere in the middle.
Okay, good. Yeah, I love I love just the lightheartedness of being able just to kind of poke fun at ourselves and the silly things we do from time to time within the church. Here's a question that's been coming in. I think it's a really great question. Seth, is there such a thing as crossing the line in satire and comedy? How does your team maintain that balance? Is there a line that you are not willing to cross? Talk a little bit more about how you maintain that balance. Can you cross that line?
We don't have, for example, like topics that we won't touch, mm-hmm. that are untouchable topics. I think really when we talk about crossing a line, it would normally have to do with the timing of when you make a joke in relation to an event that it relates to, or the approach of the joke, whether it's when I mentioned our mission statement to ridicule bad ideas. Notice I said ideas, not people. You know, the point is to attack the harmful, irrational, nonsensical, sometimes flat-out evil things that are being promoted in our culture today.
Right.
The people advancing them, sometimes they are bad people, but the point is to attack the ideas, not the people. I think that you can cross the line sometimes if you get too mean-spirited and going after the person instead of the ideas that they're advancing. I think that's absolutely possible, especially from a Christian perspective. I mean, if you're not a Christian satirist, then what do you care?
Seth, the question that's come in is, why do you stay on social media platforms that tend to be hostile toward you?
We get that question a lot. Why are you on Facebook if Facebook hates you? Why are you on Twitter if Twitter hates you so much? Why are you on YouTube? Well, I think the short version of my answer to this question would be these platforms are, in fact, the town square. They are the modern public square. And the alternatives there, and there are alternatives that exist. There's plenty of alternatives. But they're alternatives in function only. They're not alternatives in the sense that the vast majority of public discourse is happening on those platforms. In fact, you won't find anybody left of center politically, for example, on a platform that's dedicated to free speech, because like I said earlier, they don't have a problem with hate speech. They just hate speech. Yeah. They don't want to be on a platform with people who disagree with them. They consider any opinions that they disagree with politically to be misinformation or hate speech. They're not going to join a platform that celebrates hosting that speech. So you're never going to have one of these alternatives turn into what these primary platforms already are, which is the modern public square. And so if the answer to the question, do we have free speech in the modern public square, is no on these platforms, then something needs to change there. We shouldn't be leaving them voluntarily. I don't think that's the answer. I don't think censoring ourselves or sidelining ourselves from these discussions is the solution to these problems. I think insisting that we have a right to be there, if this is in fact the public square, then you know the First Amendment should be honored on these platforms.
Yeah. Could you, Seth, just pour some wisdom into us regarding the potential in being canceled? There's a question that's coming in and several questions similar to this. Can you help me navigate where I am at my job in trying to find a balance between being bold for the truth and yet I don't want to be fired? I'd rather keep my job. But what would you say to us? I mean, within the workplace, you know, we just want to be accepted, to then embraced, now celebrated. And if you don't celebrate this ideology, then you run the risk of being canceled. So what would you say to someone who's at work, maybe where more of those ideologies are espoused and celebrated? We want to keep our job because of the financial income, obviously.
Is this like a personal question from personal experience? Are you worried about speaking out here?
A little, Seth. Yes. Okay, I'll just come clean. All right, my dad. He's a scary man.
This is a great question, because it's not an easy one to answer. I think a lot of people are concerned about getting deplatformed, which is much less important than losing your job, right? Like losing your Twitter account is one. But a lot of people are. Like people are concerned at a much simpler level than that. They just don't want to be. They don't want to be banned on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube.
Yeah.
And to that I say, look, there are people in the past who were willing to lay down their lives for freedom, and we're not willing to get banned on Twitter? Like, really? I've said it before and I'll say it again. The greatest accomplishment on Twitter is not going viral. It's not building a following. It's not getting the blue check verified, whatever that you get as being a public figure. It's getting banned for saying something true. That's the greatest accomplishment on Twitter. So I don't think people should be afraid of that. Losing your access to the public square is costly, sure. But I think that if more people get banned for speaking boldly rather than staying quiet to stay on the platforms, we might actually make some progress in dealing with these problems, because we'll have a lot of people standing up together, not as outliers. And the same thing goes at work. I think that, you know, if you're working for a company where if you speak the truth boldly, you're likely to get fired, do you know why that's the case? It's because the other 300 people who also work at your company who agree with you are also silent just like you. That's why. What if you all said the same thing? What if you all agreed with you? Are they going to fire 300 of you? No. So it starts at the individual level. People have to be willing to put something on the line for their right to speak freely and speak the truth. And unless and until people are willing to do that in large numbers, there's going to be little outliers here and there that pop up and get fired and get banned. So I don't think that the answer is to try to tread really carefully. I think that people have to be willing to put something on the line. I know that's a tough answer to hear, because it's like, well, I got a wife, I got kids, I got bills to pay. I don't want to lose my job. You don't want to lose your freedom either.
That's good. Seth, this is a good question. What do you say to critics who think that your satire is too divisive or harsh? Some would say we need to be more tolerant.
Get lost.
Okay.
No,
I mean, even honestly, do you get a lot of that within the church, within Christians? You get the church even commenting on, hey, that was over the line, that was too divisive, too harsh. What's usually typically your response?
Oh, it's a tough one because it's hard to know where that's coming from, because a lot of people will tell you that you're being too divisive, and the reason they're telling you that is just because they want you to go away and not say things that make them uncomfortable or challenge their views. That's really what's behind a lot of people saying that.
Yeah.
Sometimes it comes from a genuine place of concern for others and saying, hey, look, I think that your jokes are harsh and harmful. Honestly, I do, and I'm concerned for other people or whatever. And ultimately, look, again, it comes down to the fact that I think the truth can be very divisive. I think in the truth is offensive. And we need to get out of, honestly, let's grow up a little bit. I'm sorry, but this safe space mentality that everybody wants to be in, where I don't like your jokes, you offended me, you know, I need you to stop. Well, you know, you can tune out if you'd like to. This is one of the things that's interesting about the social media platforms. You know, all these efforts to cancel people, they're made by people who have at their disposal a mute button and a block button. They can mute and block the people that they don't want to hear from, and it doesn't take away their voice.
Right.
But when it comes to, like, harshness of the jokes, you know, I don't think that when you read the Babylon Bee, I don't think that any objective reading of the Babylon Bee I don't think that you could say objectively that we are mean-spirited and nasty and trying to hurt people. We are, in good faith as Christians, I think, trying to speak truth to the culture through humor, using humor to do it. So it's a good faith effort, and if people are going to... look, people were offended by the pulpit joke. People were offended by the, you know... the baptismal water slide joke we did about one trip. Like, people...
no
people
jokes.
People get offended by everything that we publish, we can't really dance around that too much. I would say that it's important for us to kind of grow up and not be... But one more thing about the safe spaces, especially with young people. I keep coming back to young people. This is an important point. We try to protect young people so much from getting their feelings hurt these days. Like, young people need to build resilience. More than anything else, they need to build resilience.
Yeah.
And you can't do that if you protect them and insulate them from jokes that might offend them or ideas that might, you know, make them uncomfortable or challenge their preconceived ideas or whatever you taught them. Like, you can't do that. There was actually a study that was done in New York not that long ago on the playgrounds in New York City. And they were trying to determine whether or not the playgrounds were too safe. That's an interesting thing to study, isn't it? They changed these playgrounds. They retrofitted all... They revised all the playgrounds so that there was, like, really cushy, soft ground and no heights that you could fall from. You know what they found in this study? They found that the playgrounds were, in fact, too safe because they didn't put kids at any risk at all for injury. And the kids weren't learning that they could get hurt by falling from high height. So next thing you know, kids climb up a tree over a sidewalk, falls, breaks his arm, and he's shocked that it hurt. You do damage to kids when you teach them that they need to be kept safe. They build resilience through exposure. So I think that's true both physically and with ideas. That was kind of not an answer to your question, but...
No, that's fine.
But it was good. That was good.
You're not doing a very good job anyways. Seth, speaking about canceling voices, we were talking a little bit a moment ago. You were canceled not too long ago at your alma mater, Palm Beach Atlantic University. Tell us why.
Why? So I was invited to speak at the chapel at my alma mater, Palm Beach Atlantic, and a Twitter mob formed. I guess there were some students there that found out, they announced that I was going to be speaking there, and some of the students did not like that I was going to be coming there, so they got kind of loud. They started tagging the university on Twitter and saying, we can't let him come. We certainly can't let him in the chapel. The chapel's a sacred place. So the administration of the school decided, hey, you know what? We're going to change the format of the talk. Instead of you giving a speech now, we're going to do a Q&A that's moderated and controlled. I'm like, what are you afraid I'm going to say? And they were trying to get more control of the forum, I think, because they were afraid that people might protest or something like that. But then the mob kind of intensified and picked up a little bit more attention. And some emails started flooding into the administration, including the head of the chapel and all this stuff. And so I got an email notifying me that due to the chapel being a sacred place, I was no longer welcome to speak there. So I thought that was pretty wild. I made a lot of noise about that.
Yeah.
I don't think it worked out very well for them. That backfired on them because they got some negative attention in the media about it. But I think they deserved it. Christian institutions need to have a backbone. They had no backbone. They let a bunch of whiny kids on Twitter dictate what they were going to do. They had made a decision to invite me. They wanted me there. They had no problem with my views. But a bunch of whiny kids on Twitter tagged them, and all of a sudden, like, I asked the president to her face because she invited me to a meeting to discuss this afterwards. I asked her to her face. I said, you know, why are you caving to the cancel mob? You know, like, why are you letting them drive you? Who's the president of this school? There wasn't a great answer to that. They offered me a free t-shirt to make me happy. I'm serious.
Hey, this is a good question, Seth. How did the name Babylon Bee come about?
That is a good question. Well, it sounds cool, but
kind of.
Initially, when Adam was trying to come up with an idea for the site, he was toying around with things like terrible names, like the Christian Gazette or something. It was like it would have never been shared if it was the Christian Gazette. The Babylon Bee is basically the idea is that in this modern day culture and climate, Christians, especially Christians with conservative traditional values and biblical values, are somewhat ostracized, relegated to the corners. It's almost like we're in exile. And so Babylon Bee, when we're publishing these articles, the idea is that we're publishing them from a place of exile in our modern culture. So they're dispatches from exile. I think that's really kind of the gist of it.
Yeah, I think, Seth, you've touched on this, and I just want to come back to it. Someone asks, does mockery contradict the idea of speaking the truth in love? How do you separate those two?
I think it depends on how you do it. But no, I don't think it necessarily contradicts it. I think mockery is an effective way of speaking the truth. And it's loving if it's effective. And I want to make sure everyone understands what I mean by that. You know, if the point is to correct a wrong, and like I said, you know, satire being used is more of like a scalpel than a knife. It does sting, but with a healing purpose.
Right.
Then I think you're doing it in love, and you're just taking an approach that you think will be more effective than telling somebody how stupid they are in a serious, heated argument. So I don't know. I disagree with that, and I think that there's plenty of examples of mockery and exaggeration throughout Scripture. Jesus himself, I think, engaged in it. In a lot of cases, you know, there's righteous anger, and I think there's moral mockery. So I don't think that you can just write it off as being unloving, especially if the purpose of it is to deal with things in a unique and very effective way. Like I said, satire ridicules bad ideas, and good philosophy or satire must exist, if for no other reason, because bad philosophy, bad ideas must be addressed.
Yeah. Just five more minutes of your time, Seth, and then we'll dismiss you all to some refreshments in the cafe. You mentioned you had an interview with Elon Musk. How did that even come about? What was it like just talking with Elon on a casual level? And what do you perceive after your conversation with him? Because I watched the interview. If you haven't watched the interview, go watch it. But they ask him if he would accept Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior. And the answer he gave was interesting.
Yeah.
But in talking with him, what do you perceive like his worldview is and where he's at?
Well, okay, so that was a two-parter, right?
Yes.
Because the first thing is how did
come
about.
How did the Elon connection happen?
So we had a unique ability to direct message Elon Musk because he followed us on Twitter. So he followed like 100, well, I'm not going to say like 100, I know exactly. He followed 114 accounts on Twitter, and we were one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So we could message him, and we never did. We had the option to, but we never did. And while I was on vacation with my family, one of our assistant producers, for some reason, without asking me first or anybody else, sends a, like, canned message that we send out to just whoever, inviting him to come on our podcast. And it was like this, you know, "Dear Mr. Musk, we are the Babylon Bee. You may have heard of us from," you know, like it was just this dumb, lengthy, "We're located in Southern California and blah, blah, blah. Would you please be willing to come on our podcast?" And all the only thing he responded, we do have an office in California. I'm based in South Florida. But his only response was to say, "What in the world are you doing in California? That's crazy." So Patrick, the assistant producer who is having this dialogue with him, messages me, texts me, and he goes, "I have Elon Musk responding to me on Twitter. What do I do? He wants to know why we're in California." And so before I could respond, I'm on vacation with my family. Before I can respond, he's had some more dialogue with him, and he goes, "Well, the weather here is really nice." And Musk says, "Yeah, but it's the most expensive weather in the world." And I get his message, I log into Twitter, I see they're chatting about the weather, and I'm like, "Stop talking about the weather and get him on our podcast." So I messaged Musk and I said, "You know, we will leave California if you'll come on our podcast." And he said, "Deal, I'm free this weekend in Austin." And by the way, this was Friday. And he said, "I'm free this weekend in Austin. Come to me and we'll do it." And I, at the time, was in Orlando. My team was in California. So I told the guys, I was like, "We got to make this happen." So we booked flights. We booked a studio in Austin, Texas. We didn't have any firm confirmation from him that he was definitely going to come. But we showed up and we messaged him. We said we were there. We gave him the address. And an hour before he was supposed to be there, his whole security team showed up and swept the place and checked it out. And it happened. So very fortunate. So yeah. He just happens to be a fan. You know, he's liked our satire for a long time. But in that conversation with Musk, it was interesting because I think we asked him some things. We got some answers from him that, you know, I don't think many other people have gotten, or and asked some questions that he doesn't normally hear. His answers on wokeness, I think, were very insightful. Mm-hmm. His philosophy, I don't know exactly what his moral philosophy is or anything like that, or if he's even religious at all, but he's not an atheist. He seems to believe that there is a God. You know, he would say Spinoza's God, like Einstein would have said, you know, that, you know, there's a God that set things in motion, is hands off, you can't have a relationship with him, but there is a higher intelligence that he would say. And his thoughts about Jesus, you know, his opinion about Jesus is that he's a good moral teacher. And, you know, we weren't trying to have like a debate with him in this interview. Right. I would have liked to. I told Frank Turek, you guys heard from Turek recently. Yeah. I went on his show after the interview with Musk, because he wanted to ask me some of these questions about Musk. And I said, you know, I would have loved to have gotten more time with him to unpack that a little bit and talk about, you know, how could Jesus, with his radical self-understanding as being God, be a good moral teacher? If he is not, in fact, God, then he's crazy or he's lying. Right? Mm-hmm. So he's got to be God, or else he's crazy or he's lying. He can't be a good moral teacher, as Lewis said. He hasn't left that open to us. So that would be an interesting conversation I would love to have with Musk at some point.
Yeah.
Specifically challenging him on his views of Jesus in particular. But he seems very open and genuine in his search for understanding of the universe and truth. So he's the kind of guy that, he's not the kind of guy that's like one of these militant atheists that's just going to shut down everything that you say and say, "No, your beliefs are stupid." He'll hear you out. He'll say, "Why do you think Christianity is true?" And he'll listen to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And the least, hopefully that conversation just planted a seed where he'd just be curious to maybe connect
with
you
yeah.
more.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. In our closing minutes here, where do you see the future of the bee in 5-10 years?
Elon Musk buys it for $250 million. I don't know. I have a... maybe. I have a pessimistic answer, but I'm more of an optimist. So I'll tell you that, I mean, if I was a pessimist, I would say, honestly, with the way things are heading, 2 hours before I came here, 2 hours before I stepped onto the stage, we got removed from the Google Play App Store. Hmm. So, you know, we're banned on Twitter. Our email service provider canned us. We're getting removed from the app stores. I mean, if I was pessimistic about all this, I would say in 5 years we'll be irrelevant. We won't have any platforms left that anyone is actually on. And who knows where we'll be as a business or if we'll still even be in business. But I'm optimistic. I honestly think that the threat to speech is so real right now, and enough people see that. I do feel like there's momentum building towards an answer, and I don't know if the solution is going to come from, for example, the Supreme Court, you know, issuing some kind of ruling on how Section 230 and the immunity provisions there and how they apply to these platforms has been interpreted by lower courts. I know Justice Thomas has been kind of chomping at the bit to address that issue. I don't know if the Supreme Court's going to deal with it or if the Congress is going to deal with it, if state legislatures are going to draft laws. There's a bunch of legislation out there. Texas has a bill that they tried to pass that would prohibit viewpoint discrimination. Florida has one. I think Tennessee has one. There's a bunch of bills at the state level that are going through that would preserve your right to say what you think on these platforms and not be discriminated against for your either, you know, your religious or your political views. And I'm hopeful that eventually something like that will prevail, because this is the town square. These platforms are the town square, so free speech needs to be preserved there. I know that these are private companies, because everyone will always say, these are private companies, they can do whatever they want, right? Well, that's not always the case. There's common carrier doctrine that has applied to a lot of large corporations that handle, you know, telecommunications, for example, like phone companies or mass transit, that prohibit discrimination. So, you know, maybe the answer is to apply some of that precedent to these companies to make sure that we have the right to speak freely on these platforms. If that happens, the Babylon Bee can thrive. I think that, you know, I'm optimistic that it will. One way or another, there will be an answer. Maybe Musk will buy Twitter after all and make Twitter a free speech platform. I don't know. You can't always count on the richest man in the world to bail you out. That was shocking that the process even got started. But I am hopeful. And I do have faith in people that they see what's going on and that there's going to be a continued and unrelenting effort to assert our right to speak freely in the public square. So I think ultimately the bee will do well into the future and may possibly sell to Elon Musk for a minimum of $250 million. And
I love that. Seth, last two questions. Maybe last two of the last 10 that I'll ask. What's the best way to support the Bee, and how can people continue to follow your content personally, your accounts, if they still exist, and the Babylon Bee? How can people follow that content?
Well, there's a few things that you can do to support us. I mean, one way to kind of stay connected with us so that we actually... So one of the problems with these social networks is you don't own your audience, right? Twitter, we have access to 1.5 million people if Twitter allows us to access those people. We have a similar size audience on Facebook, and we barely reach any of them. We're throttled like crazy on Facebook. We used to go viral there. We used to have individual articles get shared 8 million times. We did an article about how a motorcyclist identified as a bicyclist and set a world record, and that was shared 8 million times. That's speaking the truth in love, by the way. And so we're restricted in our reach there. You can, if you get on our email list, for example, we have your information. Like, we can reach, even if our email service provider drops us, we can go to another one. Like, we can find a way to get in touch with you if we actually own our audience. So data is very important. Owning your audience is important. So for us to stay in touch with us and to be able to continue to get our content, it's important that you be like on our email list, for example. But we do have a subscription platform. People can sign up for the subscription platform and provide us with financial support. We do give you benefits for it. There's reasons to subscribe beyond that. But I think it's a great reason to subscribe to the Bee, is because we are on the front lines of this battle for the preservation of freedom and the restoration of sanity. We are doing what seemingly almost no one else is willing to do, and we're entertaining you in the process. So I think that's worth subscribing to. But the best way is not to subscribe. I like your money. It's nice. But I think that the best way to support us is to speak the truth boldly and not censor yourself, because when we do that, we give the tyrants more power than they should have. And I think that if we're an ally, like we had, when we got banned on Twitter, there were other people that got banned too that also got stuck in Twitter jail. Tucker Carlson retweeted us and he got stuck in Twitter jail. Charlie Kirk, there were a few others. You know, if the more people band together and are willing to not make the rest of us outliers by being quiet and holding it all in so that they stay safe, be willing to take that risk. Go out there and speak the truth boldly. The more of you that do that, the better off we will be in the long run, because I think it'll be better for free speech in general.
Seth, thank you for joining us. We've just so appreciated your time. Seth Dillon, everybody. We have refreshments, kettle corn in the cafe. Don't leave just yet. I wanna end on a spiritual note. I wanna pray for us. I wanna send you off the way I typically send our young adults off, by saying I love you. God loves you. He has a plan and a purpose for your life, and we're so glad that you came. Let me pray, and then you'll be dismissed. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for being with us tonight. We thank you for Seth. We thank you for just his boldness to stand for truth in a culture that loves to worship moral relativism, where truth is not absolute. And so, Lord, we pray that you would help us to stand for truth, to be bold and courageous. Fill us full with your Holy Spirit, Lord. We can't do this on our own. Many of us work in environments that are hostile to our faith. I pray that you would help us to press on, to persevere, to speak the truth in love, to not take ourselves too seriously, but to take you seriously, Lord. So we love you. We worship you. We pray that you would protect Seth, the Babylon Bee, and Seth's family. We love you, God. We do this all for your glory. It's in Jesus' name we pray, and all God's people said, amen and amen.